I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The English troubadour Billy Bragg says it's Britain's turn in the sun again in a long contest to write the pop songs of our discontent. It's not his country Billy Bragg is rooting for here. It's the sound and spirit of dissent in songs to capture the nonconformism, the none-of-the-above youthful rebellion, the popular pressure for change in Brexit Britain and Donald Trump's America. He says grime is the new genre label to be listening for.
Nowadays, all of my shows sold out. Headline tour, yeah, blood
sold out.
When we roll in, they roll out. I'm so London, I'm so south.
In England's biggest music festival this summer, grime superstars were the warm-up act for the Labour Party rock star Jeremy Corbyn.
Politics is actually about everyday life. It's about all of us, what we dream, what we want, what we achieve, and what we want for everybody else. Do you know what? The commentariat got it wrong. The elites got it wrong.
Billy Bragg is a white, English, working-class lefty from way back. On an American music map, he'd be a child of Woody Guthrie in the Pete Seeger, Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen zone of songwriters who don't have to change history, just organize it in people's heads. Grime is the end of Billy Bragg's story. His new book about roots, radicals, and rockers in transatlantic pop begins with skiffle in the 1950s, when a Glasgow boy, Lonnie Donegan, had a big hit song about an American railroad.
Down the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line is a road to ride, yes. The Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. And if you own the ride, got the ride, like you find to get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. Oh, maybe right, maybe wrong. You know you're gonna miss me when I'm gone.
I think for that generation of music makers, context is everything, because not Donegan himself, but the people that he inspired were our first teenagers. They were the first people who defined themselves as not children or not yet adults. That hadn't really happened in my country, particularly for working class youth. What happens after the war is those kids who have grown up during the 1940s, they've lived through war, and once the war ended, they've lived through sort of post-war rationing. Rationing doesn't end. Food rationing doesn't end in the UK until June 1954, just before Donegan records Rock Island Line.
Skiffle and Lonnie Donegan himself is the start of your story. Tell us about him.
He's born in Scotland. He grows up in London. He's evacuated during the war. He's not old enough to fight in the war. He's born in the 30s, like Elvis. He's that generation. And he becomes enamoured of American music while he's doing his national service as a conscript. Hmm. He's posted to Austria, to Vienna, where he works in the quartermaster stores, and he has the radio tuned all day to AFN, the American Forces Network. And because so many American soldiers in that time, the GIs, were Southerners, quite a number of them were African-American, there was a lot of great African-American music on there. There's a lot of great country on there. He kind of came home with a love of Hank Williams, some of the more R&B, people like Lonnie Johnson, who he took his name from. His real name wasn't Lonnie, his real name was Tony Donegan. Yes. In his earliest recordings, he sounds a lot like Roscoe Holcomb. He's got that high, lonesome sound. I don't know where he got it from, because he never was high, and he may have been lonesome, but the kind of vibe that he was getting was something that wasn't really there in British music. It was really interesting.
Hey, the train that I ride is 21 coaches long. My love is on. She's on that train and gone.
I think in folk music, appropriation is the means by which things are communicated. It's the way that you break down the racial barrier and ethnic barrier.
It's the ideology of Open Source.
Yeah.
The name of our show. But
yeah.
Use it, improve it, pass it on,
yeah.
Give credit.
Billy didn't write Rock Island Line. He heard that being sung. He was working with the Lomaxes. They were making a recording for the Library of Congress in a prison in Arkansas. And eight inmates came and sang Rock Island Line as a call and response song.
The Rock Island Line
is a mighty good road. If you want to ride, you got to ride it like you're fine. Buy your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line.
And, you know, John Lomax needed a recording machine the size of a fridge in order to get the song down. Leadbelly needed to hear it twice, because he just went away and borrowed a few more verses from blues and nursery rhymes and put that rap on the front of it and made it his own.
of the Rock Island Line. It's a mighty good road. If you want to ride, you got to ride it like you finally get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line.
But who wrote it, you know? It wasn't the prisoners who wrote it either. Its earliest roots are in the engine repair yards of the Rock Island Line in Biddle, which is a suburb of Little Rock. So if it belongs to anyone, it belongs to those engineers, those African-American engineers in Little Rock.
You remind us that Lonnie Donegan is the missing name in the famous observation. Was it Lennon?
George Harrison.
George Harrison, that no Lead Belly, no Beatles.
George Harrison was asked if the Beatles were influenced by the blues in any way. He said, yeah, of course. No Lead Belly, no Lonnie Donegan. No Lonnie Donegan, no Beatles. That's the kind of hidden truth of British rock. It's all down to Donegan and the guys he worked with. I mean, it's not just him alone, because there were a bunch of guys playing trad music at the time who developed what we came to call skiffle.
Unfold it. What Lonegan learned from Lead Belly and what the Beatles learned from Lonnie.
Well, what Lonnie learned from Lead Belly was what we would broadly refer to now as the blues and how to put it across. But there was something about Donegan's performance. It had a velocity to it that other music didn't have. Lead Belly was a big figure. I mean, he was a big man. He played really loud. I mean, he played a 12-string guitar really loud. And Donegan kind of picked up on some of that. But the way he sang songs really fired people up in the UK. He covered Tom Dooley by the Kingston Trio in 1959. Now, the Kingston Trio version is quite funereal. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Donegan's version is more kind of, hang down your head, Tom Dooley. That's the difference. And very young guys, 13, 14, 15-year-olds, that was the ages of George Harrison, Paul McCartney and John Lennon when they first heard Lonnie Donegan. They were really excited by this, and it inspired them to do something that had never been done in British culture before, which was to pick up a guitar.
Hang down.
The guitar was the instrument of the outsider, of the singing cowboy, of the old blues guy who came to the country occasionally, of the Calypsonians who arrived from the Caribbean in the 1940s. It was an outsider instrument, and the guitar represented a break with the past for the generation that picked it up at age 13, 14, 15. It was a rejection of their parents' values and a way of creating their own identity, and that identity was the identity of the teenager, neither child nor adult. It hadn't really been visible before in our culture.
What did you take to be the politics of that spirit in the 50s?
Well, it was a very working-class movement, skiffle, because it comes to the fore in 1955 when the first generation of war babies leave school. And the middle-class and the upper-class teenagers are not involved at all, because they tend to go into further education, to go to university, and then to go into professions such as the law or medicine. So really, skiffle is a working class phenomenon. It's working class kids making music for other working class kids. Again, that's not something that's happened in our culture before songs are written in Tin Pan Alley or they come in American films. This is something different. It's an interesting paradox, because I think in the United States of America, when the folk boom became visible, there were artists like the New Lost City Ramblers, who were almost exact contemporaries of Lonnie Donegan. They used this music to find a way back. You know, they went back to Appalachia to find Roscoe Holcomb and Doc Watson. They were trying to, I think, use that music to reconnect with the past that they felt was being lost. Skiffle kids were doing the absolute opposite. They were trying to make the future happen. They were trying to induce a new reality by using the guitar, because they'd grown up in this, you know, rationing, wearing hand-me-downs. You can't really have anything new. And when, in 55, Rock Around the Clock gets in the charts in the UK, and the BBC barely plays it, hardly plays it. And I think the skiffle kids thought to themselves, you're going to ration rock and roll? You think you're going to ration rock and roll? I'll tell you what, old timer, what you can do with that. We're going to get guitars and we're going to play this music, whether you like it or not. There's that impulse in it as well to create your own music. So it's a two-part idea. The first part is you don't have to be a trained musician to make music. That's clear. Donegan's song has three chords on a guitar. Anyone can play that. And the second thing is you don't have to be an American to sing American folk songs. And these are quite important ideas, you know. It's like there's a thing going on in playgrounds at the moment across the world called the fidget spinner. I don't know if you're familiar with it. You put your fingers in the middle, you flick your wrist like that, it spins around, it makes a noise. I read about it in the New York Times yesterday. It's definitely happening here. It's happening in the UK. Skiffle was more akin to that. It was like a playground craze. Every sentient schoolboy in the UK could play three chords on either his guitar or a guitar he made with his dad or one he borrowed. And what happens then is when Chuck Berry turns up 6 months later playing guitar like a ring and a bell, all these kids can immediately play his repertoire. So when the Beatles have their first number one in 1964, there's a whole cohort of British bands who've been playing for ages. And that's how you get the British invasion of the charts. It wasn't an accident. It was Skiffle gave those kids an edge on their white American contemporaries to be able to invade the charts.
So in the wide world of Skiffle, enter Lennon and McCartney and George Harrison, eventually Ringo. How do you feel about that now? They took a great idea and God knows ran with it.
Well, I mean, interestingly, when they got to Hamburg in 1960, when they were actually called the Beatles, they originally were called the Quarrymen. The Quarrymen was Lennon's band. He meets Paul McCartney on the 6th of June, 1957, the moment we refer to as peak Skiffle. In the summer of Skiffle, they meet, and in many ways, Skiffle's work is done then when those two meet.
Billy Bragg is our guest. His book is Roots, Radicals, and Rockers. Coming up, Billy Bragg, the performer. Love songs may have been his favorites, but politics has been his passion. This is Open Source. Our guest, Billy Bragg, has been singer-songwriter and historian in the thick of the storm of styles and stars in transatlantic pop music since World War II. He was born just south of London into the end of post-war austerity in 1957, when the rockabilly skiffle sound was about to be overtaken by the lads from Liverpool.
Oh, I first heard the Beatles. I think I saw the Beatles on the Sunday night at the London Palladium singing She Loves You, which must have been 63, probably. It's one of our earliest memories. My brother was born in 62, and that's when we got a television. So, yeah, it must have been around then.
You think you've lost your love? Well, I saw her yesterday, yeah.
And, yeah, they were just huge at school. They were... Although, actually, I will be honest and say I was more of a fan of Freddie and the Dreamers. I think they more appealed to a six-year-old. Because he kind of jumped around and was like, looked like a goof, an all-round goof. I didn't really kind of connect with the Beatles until a bit later, until they started writing the sort of great pop hits, Strawberry Fields, Penny Lane, all that kind of stuff. Mm. That really started connecting with me.
And when did you start
playing guitar myself?
Yeah.
In 1974, I'd finished my school exams and got my dad to buy me a guitar before the results came in, which was just as well.
And where did the Beatles stand in that, in your head then, as a kid? As a young guitar player, who were the Beatles?
They were kind of the greatest band that ever lived. That was undoubtedly true. But in my taste, I was much more a fan of singer-songwriters and Tamla Motown, American pop soul. Right. So I was listening to Smokey Robinson. I was listening to Marvin Gaye. I was listening to Simon and Garfunkel, Bob Dylan. That was my, when I wanted to play guitar. Rod Stewart, I listened to a lot of Rod Stewart. The Who. I listened to a lot of The Who. So that was where the Beatles had kind of been and gone by the time I got into it.
And was it the sound or was it something about the politics, the cultural stance?
Well, interestingly, it was the sound, but I think if you listen to American soul music in the late 60s, you kind of got the politics by osmosis. I mean, if you listen to Motown Chartbusters Volume 5, after ABC by the Jackson 5 is Edwin Starr sings War.
Yeah. What is it good for? Absolutely
nothing. Uh-huh. And then you got the Supremes, and then you got the Temptations sing Ball of Confusion. Something's happened. Something's happened since Volume 4, which is almost all poppy. Now there's something, and the clue is in there, if you dig deeper, because buried in the back of the running order is Marvin Gaye singing Abraham, Martin and John. What has happened is Martin Luther King has been assassinated, and the civil rights movement has turned dark, and the possibility of a bright horizon in America has been nullified by the assassinations of the Kennedy brothers and Dr. King.
Can you tell me where he's gone?
Oh, and you kind of pick that up listening to the music. So I came of a generation where music was our only social medium. It was the way we spoke to one another and spoke to our parents. And it had to encompass everything: politics, love, football, the weather, haircuts, everything. And if you were 19 years old and angry about the world as I was, the only way to have your voice heard was to learn to play guitar, write songs and do gigs. There was no other medium available to someone like me.
I was going to say, does anything beat music?
I don't think so. I've never come across anything like it. You know, if you're looking for release, if you're looking for something to change your mood, if you're looking for something that can have an effect on you without putting horrible chemicals in your body, I think music's better than anything else.
I think you're right. From that growing up perspective, late 60s, early 70s, I mean, how did the Beatles sound to a young kid whose political mind is maturing like yours?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a political element, John Lennon's political element, kind of connected with it. You know, I can remember hearing the White Album and thinking that, you know, they were trying to say something, do something here. And they were, you know, the Beatles were that generation that didn't know you couldn't change the world through music. You know, Phil Oakes' generation. You know, Phil believed that the world could be changed because his world had been changed by Elvis Presley. He'd brought black and white youth together through rock and roll. So maybe they could do that through politics. They didn't know that musicians can't change the world like we do now. So it cost Phil his life. It destroyed him in the end. So it's best to, you know, understand how this works.
Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore.
Remind me, I think I saw Phil Oakes playing and singing in Chicago in 1968.
You did.
At the Democratic Convention.
In the park, yeah.
And then what happened?
After that failed, and after the assassinations, particularly Bobby Kennedy, I think, he kind of started to drift away. And eventually he hung himself at his sister's house in Long Island in the early 70s. I think because he took the struggle too personally. There's a lesson for us all there.
Spell it out.
Woody's guitar didn't kill fascists in its simplest terms. You have to understand that. It's an idea we put out. We're not the solution. You know, we're at best a signpost, at worst a mirror. Don't expect the world to change just because you wrote a song about it, you know? Woody's guitar inspired people to join the anti-fascist cause and do that work, and that's our role.
Well, I'm gonna tell you, fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose, you fascists, bound to lose.
We set out to inspire people, make them feel like they're not alone, give them the wherewithal to overcome their cynicism and act. But we're not leaders. We're not people with solutions. We're just offering a different perspective.
When did fascism come into view for you, and how did it enter your vocabulary and your thinking?
During punk, I was a fan of a band called The Clash. And The Clash were one of the supporters of a group called Rock Against Racism. And they organised a huge carnival in 1978, a big march through the streets of London to a place called Victoria Park in Hackney, where there was a big gig on. And that was my first ever political activism, the first thing I ever did was political. And the experience I had that day remains the basis of how I perceive pop is able to, and rock is able to engage in the process of bringing about some form of change.
Breaking rocks in a hot sun. I fought the law and the law won. I fought the law and the law won. I needed money cause I had none. I fought the law and the law won. I fought the law and the law won.
What was your image of fascism? What, I mean, you're a post-war child. How do you see it? Where did you see it?
The obvious image of fascism were the Nazis who bombed our house. You know, I mean, my dad was out in the streets as a Boy Scout during the Blitz, you know, trying to put out fires with my granddad because they were flying over. They had a direct hit on a house 3 houses from ours, blew out all our windows out. So there was them fascists. And then there were them fat, sweaty blokes in the National Front who were marching through the streets in the late 1970s, whose party, the National Front, came third in the all London city elections in 1974, who, you know, were selling their youth newspaper outside my school, those people. Mm. And Rock Against Racism was a response to that. And so I went along with my friends and got to the park in Hackney, and there was like 100,000 kids just like me there. And the top of the bill that day was a guy named Tom Robinson. And he had a song called Sing If You're Glad To Be Gay. He was a gay man. And when he sang this song, all the fellas around where me and my mates are standing started kissing each other on the lips. Now, I was 19, 20. I'd never met an out gay man. I mean, I grew up in a sort of industrial suburb of eastern London. I'd never met an out gay man. And all of a sudden, there were all these gays kissing each other. And my initial thought was, why are these gay men at this event? This is about black people. But it didn't take long, 5 minutes, to realise that actually the fascists are against anybody who's in any way different, and that their fight, these gay men, their fight is the same as our fight against racism. It's actually discrimination that we're against. Happens here.
Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way.
And that's kind of that was the big penny drop for me. You know, I came away from that place with my view of the world changed. And it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't have been there in that place. You know, when I went back to work on Monday morning, I started speaking up when the men I worked with were casually racist or sexist or homophobic. And the crucial thing you have to understand, though, is that it wasn't the clash that gave me the courage of my convictions. It was being in that audience with those 100,000 other kids just like me and realising I was not alone in the way I felt, realising that my generation were going to define themselves in opposition to discrimination of all kinds in the way the previous generation defined themselves in opposition to the Vietnam War, and the generation before that defined themselves in opposition to nuclear weapons. And so, you know, what changed me was the actual experience of that audience. The Clash did a great job. They got me there. That's very important. Tom did a great job. He sang Sing If You're Glad To Be Gay, which allowed those gay men to openly express their identity, which had an effect on me. But it was those guys, really, it was those brave gay men and all the other kids in the audience that made me feel that I wasn't the only person who cared about this stuff. And I think that's one of the key things that perhaps the most that music can do. It can make you feel that you're not alone, you know.
What was the music at that moment?
And that we all... Oh, Police and Thieves by The Clash, probably. That's kind of like a mix-up of Jamaican reggae and London punk, which probably sums up best what we were talking about that day.
Police and thieves in the street. Oh, yeah. Scaring the nation with their guns and ammunition. Police and thieves in the street.
How are you seeing sort of the reigning class public conversation in England those days? What was wrong with it? What was workable? But also, how did you see the states?
Well, the ruling class were exemplified by Margaret Thatcher and her policies, and she was clearly against the likes of me. I didn't bother to vote in 79.
When did that dawn on you?
Oh, after I failed to vote against her in the 1979 election because I didn't think politics was anything to do with me. so I didn't bother. And then before the next election, we had the Falklands War, we had an American nuclear missile sighted in our country, and we had the dismantling of the welfare state. So I realised that even if I wasn't interested in politics, I was interested in me, so I better get my arse in gear and do something about it. And in the United States of America, I think, I grew up with quite a benign sense of the United States of America, and that changed when Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980. And
spell it out.
Well, you know, the Cold War was kind of going nowhere, and Thatcher and Reagan come along, and it's in their interest to stir up the Cold War again, because they have no ideology, they just have nationalism. You know, the Republican Party is basically the American Nationalist Party, and perhaps we're seeing it even more nakedly now. You know, America first, make America great again. You know, that's not the traditional role of someone like FDR, taking more responsibility and working with other nations around the world to bring about things. And if you think by walking away from your responsibilities, nothing's going to change. The Chinese are already in there, in like Flynn, filling those gaps that you're leaving. You know, the world is changing. And in some ways, I think that's maybe why Trump was elected, because it's kind of running away from you the same way it's running away from us. I mean, it's the same impulse behind Brexit. The world is changing quickly, and we're no longer in charge.
Billy Bragg, I'm listening for a history of sort of British dissent from the Thatcher years to this moment when dissent is surging. What are the great landmarks there?
Well, there's one great landmark, really. There's one great landmark over which everything changes. That's the 1984 coal miners' strike. That changes everything.
Mid-Reagan in our country.
Yeah, it changed everything. Yeah, it's in Thatcher's second term. She takes on the National Union of Mine Workers. They had some history with the Conservative Party. In 1974, they went on strike, and the Conservative Prime Minister, then Prime Minister Edward Heath, called an election on the question of who runs the country, and lost. They threw him out. The miners won. So when Thatcher got into power, the Tories wanted to revisit that fight and destroy the power of the union. So when the National Union of Mine Workers went on strike, the Tories were already waiting for them. In fact, they provoked the strike, because what they did first was they made sure that coal stocks were really high. They did it in the spring.
Stockpiling.
Yep, stockpiled coal. They put in some new trade union laws, and they did it in the spring. So it would be a long time before people were going to need power in the power stations. And over the course of a year, they brought the entire power of the state to bear on trade unionists and their supporters like me, to the extent where some areas of the country were like a police state. And that's ultimately what politicised my generation, to go from being personally political to be ideological political, to be beyond, you know, just sort of talking about it, actually doing something about it.
You're a performer right now, and what were you singing?
Well, initially I was singing old punk songs, and then I went up and did some gigs in the coal fields, and there were folk singers up there whose songs were more radical than mine, so I had to kind of revisit some older songs. So I kind of repurposed an old Joe Hill song, borrowed the title, which is called There's Power in a Union, and I took an old song from the American Civil War called Rally Round the Flag, the chorus of which is the Union forever, hurrah boys, hurrah. And I sort of stuck them together and wrote some new lyrics and come up with my own union anthem called There Is Power in a Union. Mm-hmm. I later found out that the tune for Rally Round the Flag had been stolen from an English hymn, so I thought, okay, don't feel so bad about it now. Like so much in our exchanges.
There's power in a factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. But it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand. There is power. Lessons of the past were all learned with workers' blood. Mistakes of the bosses we must pay for. From the cities and the farmlands to trenches full of mud. War has always been the bosses' way, sir. The Union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg, the workers unite. Our brothers and our sisters in many far-off lands. There is power in a union.
I'm sure you know the movie Pride, about a kind of convergence of identity politics and economic politics in the miners' strike.
I do very well. Very well indeed. The main character is a young gay man who organises a minor support group. His name is Mark Ashton, and he was a volunteer for Red Wedge. He worked with me during Red Wedge, and sadly, he was the first person I know to die of AIDS. He was 21. So that movie was quite a trip down memory lane for me. They were amazing times, and I'm really glad that someone took the trouble to memorialise that group. They were only a small group, but the area they were working in, challenging working class perceptions of sexuality, of gender, of race as well. Those miners were hardcore, some of them, to start with, but by the end of it, you know, I think we helped change their views somewhat. That's what solidarity will do for you.
Coming up, the new music in England that anticipated an efflorescence of resistance underground on the way to Brexit and the rise of Jeremy Corbyn. This is Open Source. Billy Bragg draws an interesting broad line in the late 1970s, a cultural and political border crossing into the Margaret Thatcher years in England, the Reagan years in the U.S. David Graeber, the American anthropologist and historian who's lived a long time in England, made a similar observation to us last month that the songs of the British invasion, Beatles and Rolling Stones, had been written by and for children of the welfare state. Rock and roll was in fact Cockney slang for the dole. After 1979, Mrs. Thatcher adopted and enforced austerity by choice. The unspoken slogan to the Sex Pistols generation sounded like, no future for you. And punk became the sound of resistance.
Yeah, I mean, I think no future was a lyric from a Sex Pistols song.
My man Johnny Rotten.
Yeah.
Johnny Rotten Lydon, remember.
Indeed, yeah. So it's kind of, it's very much part of that whole nihilistic punk thing. There was other strains in punk as well that were trying to be a bit more progressive. I mean, Joe Strummer came out of the sort of squatting politics. That was a little bit more organised, a bit more anarchistic, probably anarchistic, not just the word, the way that the Pistols used it. But yeah, punk was very much what I identified with. It was a rejection of everything that went before. But I still had this trouble about walking it like you talk it. I still had to find some way of making music that actually was connected to reality and not just talking about stuff, but actually, you know, at what point does it connect with action? And that's how we came to Red Wedge.
Talk about it a little bit, the sound of it and the spirit of it.
Well, really, it's just pop stars for socialism would be the best way to explain it, I suppose. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's the pop star, the great pop stars of the day. Sade, one of our great soul chanteuses. Paul Weller from Style Council.
You don't have to take this crap. You don't have to sit back and relax.
You can actually try to change it.
I know we've always been taught to rely upon rules and authority, but you never know until you try. How fierce just might be.
And we put on gigs at which Labour Party members of Parliament would be in the foyer if you wanted to talk to them. We didn't have them on stage making speeches. And during the daytime in that city, we would have a day event where young people would meet with us and with the MPs and thrash a few things out.
Of course, Thatcher and Reagan were the first twin regime, in a sense. Bill Clinton and Tony Blair were another, sort of ping-ponging ideologies back and forth across the Atlantic. What were you doing in the Tony Blair time? What were you thinking?
Well, I mean, I was still kind of doing what I was doing, but I wasn't very fashionable. In fact, I've never really been fashionable, which is kind of fine, because I'm not really interested in that. I would rather be relevant than fashionable. So, yeah, I was just kind of writing songs, having kids, getting on with being a musician, you know. It's been a long, strange trip until Jeremy Corbyn got elected leader of the Labour Party, and we're all of a sudden back to the politics of my youth.
This was the period when you rediscovered Woody Guthrie.
Yeah, but, I mean, you know, making Mermaid Avenue, it was a great honour for me, and I really enjoyed it, and I learned a lot from it.
I lived in a place called Ofusky, and I had a little girl in a hollow tree. I said, little girl, it's plain to see, ain't nobody that can sing like me, ain't nobody that can sing like me.
And what was Woody Guthrie's ghost saying to you?
Woody Guthrie's ghost was saying to me, why don't you write some new tunes for these lyrics I wrote all that time ago? I mean, Guthrie wrote over 3,000 songs, of which he only recorded 10%. His daughter, Nora, these songs were languishing in boxes at the family home, and she was looking for someone to come in and write some new music, and she employed me to do that, and I invited Wilco to join me. It was brilliant. It was like going to the dressing up box every day. Who do you want to be? And it wasn't all political either. I mean, you know, he wrote a great song about wanting to make love to Ingrid Bergman on the slopes of an Italian volcano, in which the volcano is a metaphor for his tumescent manhood.
Ingrid Bergman, let's go make a picture on the island of Stromboli. Ingrid Bergman.
So in comparison with what I was doing in the 1980s, the 1990s were more of a kind of a having a career in music and trying to think of interesting ways to address issues and trying to pick issues that weren't easily digestible by the left, one of which was Englishness. I made an album called England Half English, which I tried to sort of talk a bit about English identity, which is not a popular subject on the left in the UK.
My mother was half English and I'm half English too. I'm a great big bundle of culture tied up in the red, white and blue. I'm a fine example.
But I felt that the our failure to talk about it, to express a left-wing sense of belonging, gave a free pass to the neo-fascists in the British National Party, who were winning council seats at the time. So I thought we really need to talk about this. I mean, it's still not particularly popular, but...
In your book, you quote that marvellous Orwell line, I think it was in 1940, but British society is a family run by the wrong members.
The wrong members in charge, yeah.
Spell that out.
It's from The Lion and the Unicorn, perhaps the greatest book ever written about Englishness and socialism. It's actually called The Lion and the Unicorn, Socialism and the English Genius. And he means by genius, he means the sort of sense of a genus loci, you know, it's almost belonging he's talking about rather than anything else. And, you know, Orwell still has a lot to tell us. He's kind of our Woody Guthrie in many ways, because you can interpret what he says in a number of different ways, you know. 1984, go back and read it again. It's all about Donald Trump. It's all about Donald Trump. It's just, I took part in a reading of 1984, a live reading. The bits I was reading, it was so it's so resonant of what's going on with Trump. At one point when O'Brien is interrogating poor old Winston, he says, you know, in the past, people base their politics on the common good and making life better. Ours will be based on hatred and fear and driving people apart and self-aggrandizement. Everything else we will destroy, everything. I mean, I read that and a chill went through me. I'll be perfectly honest with you. A chill went through me and I thought of the orange-haired monster. Go back and read 1984. Every time I read it every 10 years, it has a different meaning every 10 years. So,
Bring us through Brexit, but also to this new government, if it really is one, of Theresa May, and the Corbyn shock, the Corbyn surprise. David Graeber, again, spoke of an efflorescence of resistance building up in England, maybe a year, 18 months. Have you seen it?
I have. I've seen it firsthand. Brexit, the vote of Brexit went down over Glastonbury weekend last year, biggest rock festival in Europe, possibly the world, where I run a stage called The Left Field, where we put on debates and left-wing artists. And it went down on a Thursday night. So on Friday morning, there was a lot of upset people around, a lot of upset people. And I went to get my coffee. And there were two guys behind me in the queue who recognised me. I guess they might have been in their late 20s. And they were like, wow, Bill, Brexit, what are you going to do, man? What are you going to do? I turned around to them, they're bigger than me, and I said, what am I going to do? What am I going to do, mate? It's not my future, it's just gone down the toilet, is it? I've been to all those places, I've worked in those places around the world. What are you going to do, sunshine, to sort this out? You know, because this is your future they're talking about. You're not going to be able to go and work in Europe. You're going to live in a country that's cut itself off from the world. What are you going to do? And they answered that on June the 8th this year, during our general election. They were woke. Brexit woke them up, just like Margaret Thatcher getting elected woke me up. Brexit woke them up. It was the young people who went out and voted in sufficient numbers to derail Brexit, which is where we kind of are now, where it's kind of zombie Brexit we've got at the moment. And at this year's Glastonbury Festival, at all kind of times of the day when you were wandering around, and in the middle of the night when you're lying in your bunk, you could hear groups of young people chanting the name of Jeremy Corbyn to the tune of Seven Nation Army by the White Stripes.
How does it sound?
Oh, Jeremy Corbyn.
Oh, Jeremy Corbyn. Hey!
They did it on the Saturday night. The BBC broadcast Radiohead set live on national TV on Saturday night prime time. And being Radiohead, they spent a lot of time fossicking about in the dark, being art students. And in these gaps, the audience, 70,000 people, were chanting Jeremy Corbyn's name live on TV for 90 seconds. I mean, the Tories must be pulling their hair out. I'm more hopeful now than I've been at any time since in
hopeful,
the last...
Hopeful of what, Billy?
That the young people are going to step up, take responsibility, and they're going to vote in sufficient numbers and remain engaged, that the mainstream parties have to take notice of them. Because at the moment, the division that we have is one of age. Anyone over 55 was predominantly voted to leave. Anyone under 55 predominantly voted to remain. Anyone over 55 votes Tory. Anyone under 55 votes Labour or Liberal Democrat or Green. So there's this division at the moment. And we've got to reconcile that in some way. So if they remain engaged, now they've got this sort of scent of blood in their nostrils. I'm kind of hoping they'll keep going. And this is the interesting thing about Corbyn. You know, when I was doing my set on Friday night at Left Field, there was a guy who kept starting the chant, the Corbyn chant, which is fine, I didn't mind it. But I had to say to him at one point, mate, you've got to understand something. It's not him, it's us. We did this. He didn't do that. He's got no more idea why this happened than anybody else. You've got to understand that really since the crash in 2008, all of the opportunities where people have got to vote in my country have been votes against the centre, against Westminster. We had the Scottish referendum, that nearly went pear-shaped. They only just won that back. And then you add the Brexit vote, that goes against the centre. The election of Jeremy Corbyn as well was a vote against the centre by members of the Labour Party, against the mainstream political view. Yep. And I think Trump was that as well. Trump was that. I mean, the thing that worried me most about Hillary was that she wasn't the change candidate. People want change. People are sick of the way the economy is being run, and they want someone to change it. And if no one comes along to change it, they'll vote for the guy who's just going to smash it up. And that's where we are at the moment. You know, the bull in the china shop in my country is Brexit. Smash it all up then. If you're not going to change it, let's destroy it. And there's that impulse is out there. It's still abroad in this country because, you know, Trump's base has not deserted him yet. So you have what do you do then? You either just carry on and let it go as it's going, or you put together a different way that you could run the economy and offer that to people. No one's done that yet. And Corbyn started to do that in the UK. He started to try and pull that together. But even he, my one criticism of him is he is a person of the 20th century. He's not a person of the 21st century. He doesn't understand.
What does that mean?
It means his politics are broadly statist. He's not understanding that power needs to be spread to everybody, that everybody's vote needs to count, that we need an electoral system that's proportional and not just delivers winners. He's not really grasped that. If he was really radical, he'd be talking about changing the voting system and abolishing the House of Lords and making sure that everybody has a say in a society. You can't have an economy that works for everybody if you don't have a democracy that works for everybody.
Who's writing the song? Who's making the music of this moment?
In my country, the best political music is being made by the urban community, young black men who make a music called Grime, which is a mixture of high-speed hip-hop and Jamaican dancehall. And they are still using music in the way that the rest of us use music in the 20th century. Mm. They use it to talk to one another and to their detractors, you know?
By now you should know I hate waiting, I got no patience. Right now, man, I'm trying to get out the matrix, far from the agents. Trying to stay far from the devil in the red dress, far from the pagans. Only time man are gonna see me again is if I share location.
The reason they use music to express their views is because it's the only chance they have to get into your timeline and my timeline, because nobody else is going down there listening to them. And it was, I think, significant that during the election, they were the only community that stood with Jeremy Corbyn. There was actually a Grime 4, number 4, Corbyn movement of grime artists coming up and saying, we've got to vote for Jeremy Corbyn. You don't get your Ed Sheerans and that lot stepping up. I mean, old folkies like me, of course we were there, of course. But the fact that it was grime artists, I think, is very, very significant.
Jeremy Corbyn took lots of time with grime artists before the voting in June. Here, he was chatting with JME at a cafe in London.
Voter registration dropped off over many years, particularly amongst young people. In the last election, less than half of under 25s voted, who were eligible to vote.
Yeah.
I want it to be much, much higher.
I think, but one thing that I want to make sure I do say, that I've never voted before, ever, ever. I've grown up like making the best out of what I've got.
Yeah.
And being optimistic with what I've got. Like, if somebody was to ask me why don't young people vote, I would say it's because they actually think that it won't make a difference.
And they don't see any resonance of what they think and do.
Yeah.
With a political system that's out of touch with them.
With them, yeah. If I can do something really small that has a big change, I'll do it.
The main thing is to make sure people remember to register to vote. That's the most important thing.
We both do it together.
Together?
Okay, cool.
You see, I'm Jeremy.
Make sure you register to vote.
Almost.
Because everyone goes, oh, there's no political music anymore. You know, that's because you're looking for white boys with guitars again. There's no new Bob Dylan, there's no new Beatles. But it doesn't mean there isn't great political music. So don't tell me no one's writing political music anymore.
In England and in this country, it strikes me that the most interesting thing is that the official scorekeepers, the BBC, shall we say, or the New York Times, are still don't get it. And we're trying to talk across a gap of standardized centrist conversation that seems more and more irrelevant, but they're still there.
Yeah, well, the trouble with the New York Times and the BBC and people like that is they're working in a reality-based format. We've passed that now. We're at the other side of that.
Where are we?
We're in a place where a racist bigot can be elected president of the United States of America. The worst of all candidates can rise to the top, voted in by people who see themselves reflected in him because he's a man who doesn't give a shit about anybody else, and nor do they. And the sooner we find those people and the sooner we confront them with what they've done, the better we can get through all this and get back to building that shining city on the hill. Because at the moment, you're building nothing but an outside toilet on a hill, you know? And that needs to change. In my country, it's Brexit. It's doing the same thing. We've got to not just derail it, but we've got to put together a better society that rather than just acquiesces to the European Union, that reforms the European Union to make it a union for people, not for profit. There's a lot of work there to be done. Mm. And it's not be done by going back to the language of Marx. The language of Marx is dead, you know. But instead, there's the issues that he talked about haven't been resolved. So we've got to find a language in which to resolve those problems and communicate that to each other. And the hyper-individualism that we see now with the internet has to be challenged. Mm. And the hyper-cynicism that comes with it also has to be challenged. Mm. It's a big fight. But there are enough people out there willing to stand up, as far as I can see. Everyone from the grind guys to Woody's old friends, who you see him around, people like yourself. You know, there are enough of us out there. We just need to find a way of focusing. But, you know, expecting it to be Hillary, you're wasting your time. We're past that. We're so far past that. It's change people want. They want change. And if they can't get change, they'll take chaos.
We will watch carefully. What's our song going out?
Waiting for the Great Leap Forward.
Have you written it?
I surely did.
Mixing pop and politics, he asks me what the use is. I offer him embarrassment and my usual excuses while looking down the corridor out to where the van is waiting. I'm looking for the Great Leap Forward.
Billy Bragg's book is Roots, Radicals and Rockers, How Skiffle Changed the World. There are playlists and more on our website, radioopensource.org. While you're there, think about signing up for the Open Source newsletter and making a donation to the hardest working team in radio. We'll send you one of our post-punk t-shirts. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, and Becca DiGregorio, rockers all. Vintage rocker George Hicks mixed the program. Mary McGrath is our child of the Clash. In the extended Johnny Rotten family, I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.